young Karl Marx in the United States in the aftermath of the Parkland massacre and the remarkable uprising of the students who are taking on the entrenched power of the NRA. We have 10 seconds.
Well, that's the thing. Capitalism and people like LaPierre makes you believe that we cannot change anything because that's the way it is. And Marx and those young children are telling you no, because human beings make history. So if you get together and if you're a collective, you can change anything you set your minds to.
Well, Raoul Peck, we're going to continue our conversation. And by the way, congratulations on your BAFTA, the equivalent of the Oscars in the United States, for I Am Not Your Negro, about James Baldwin. The new film, The Young Karl Marx, out today in New York and Los Angeles. I am Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Special thanks to our producers, Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Nina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. The time now is 8 o'clock, and coming up next is Positively Revolting, where Ani welcomes Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz to KBOO to discuss her new book, Loaded. Call in and join the conversation.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Il Camille and Fritzois. Saturday, February 24th from 8 to 11 p.m. at the Tonic Lounge in Portland. From Los Angeles, MC Il Camille's divine mission is to uplift the world through Heirloom, her latest record. Fritzois' latest, the self-written and produced Avenue A, is filled with a soul-drenched sound that doesn't quite sit in a neat box of influences. The night also includes DJ sets by DJ Black Daria and DJ Shishi of Everyday Mixtapes. This is a 21 and over event. Again, that's Il Camille and Fritzois, Saturday, February 24th from 8 to 11 p.m. at the Tonic Lounge, 3100 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Radio trains media makers. We believe community resilience happens when citizens know how to make their own media. For the last 50 years, KBOO has trained thousands of citizen journalists to report on what goes on in the streets of Portland and far beyond. We know that with our expertise and your support, we can keep this city activated and aware through radio. Invest in Portland's future media makers and join KBOO on Kickstarter today.
Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Donate to the campaign and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
There comes a time.
And good morning, good morning. It is about 2 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning, and you are tuned to your community radio station, KBOO. You are listening to Positively Revolting, and I'm your host, Ani. This morning, I'm really excited to have the opportunity to speak with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. She's the author of many books, including the most recent, Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, also An Indigenous People's History of the United States, and Red Dirt, Growing Up Okie, Roots of Resistance, A History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, and Blood on the Border, A Memoir of the Contra War. She's the recipient of the Cultural Freedom Prize for a Lifetime Achievement by the Landon Foundation. Roxanne, thank you so much for joining us in the studio this morning.
Thank you so much, honey.
It's great to have you here. I want to note that we actually scheduled this interview back in December before the shooting last week at Douglas High School, in which 17 people were killed and another 15 wounded. According to the Washington Post, more than 150,000 students attending at least 170 primary or secondary schools have experienced a shooting on campus since the Columbine School Massacre in 1999. That doesn't account for dozens of suicides, accidents, and after-school assaults that have also exposed children to gunfire. Indeed, there were more than 370 mass shootings in the U.S. in 2015. And on average, about 100 people a day are killed by guns. Of that number, on average, 7 are youths. So in the face of this devastating reality, we hear the polarized pitch cries calling for increased gun control on one side and the absolute near-sacred right to own and carry firearms on the other side. But we're not getting a whole lot of context about gun culture or the history of the Second Amendment. This morning, we are here to do just that, delving more deeply into the background of this issue and discussing that aspect, America's gun culture and its roots in the genocidal taking of land and the control of slaves. Let's just jump straight into it. An hour is going to be too short. In your book, you write that taking land by force was not an accidental or spontaneous project, nor work of a few rogue characters. The violent appropriation of native land by white settlers was seen as an individual right in the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, second only to the freedom of speech. Male colonial settlers had long formed militias for the purpose of raiding and razing indigenous communities and seizing their lands and resources, and the native communities fought back. Virginia, the first colony, forbade any man to travel unless he was well armed. In 1658, that colony ordered every settler home to have a functioning firearm, and later even provided government loans for those that could not afford to buy their own weapons. There was a similar law that took place in New England in the 17th century as well, and I'm assuming that was the norm, that was the expectation in early settler, what became America. Can you talk about the reasons the white men were required to carry arms at that time?
Well, it's an aspect of settler colonialism. It's not just unique to New England and Virginia and the 13 colonies, but it's unique when it becomes the independent United States. It also happened in New Zealand, Australia, Canada, vicious, horrible massacres intentional by settlers, the same setup. And all of them, these many of them, were settlers from Ulster, from Northern Ireland, who were Scottish settlers who were given land in the same way as settlers to take Irish, Catholic, indigenous Irish land. And this is a situation that goes on today, that settler colonialism is still there in Northern Ireland. And so they then, you know, subsequently and very soon after controlling Northern Ireland, they began the colonialism of North America. And so they use the same methods. They use the methods of body parts for bounty. They used heads at first, and they put the heads along the roadside in Ireland so people could see their relatives and loved ones dead, and they would be terrified. That's what they said in their plan to do this, was this would terrify people so that they would just give up. And they did this, of course, in New England, and then it turned to just using the scalp, a part of the head, because it became so cumbersome to carry all these heads. Heads weigh a lot. And it became an enterprise, you know, how some people made their living. So they were rewarded for these things. It was in opposition. This was the way they then could, because settler colonialism seeks to ethnically cleanse a territory and replace it with permanent settlers. And it's pretty unusual in the whole 500 years of European imperialism in the non-European Christian world, only in those few places and a few others, Southern Africa, of course, famously, and our later Spanish colonies like Argentina and Paraguay and Uruguay and and Chile, where they same kind of brutality. Now, the difference in all of these is the, this taking of land, this being very rich land. This was one of the seven sites of the founding of agriculture. And I mean horticulture, not plantation agriculture, food production and sustenance was east of the Mississippi, North America east of the Mississippi. Of course, another one is Central Mexico, and that had come from Central Mexico. That was the heartland, and also the Andes. But that was like the Tigris-Euphrates, what Europeans date their civilization from, the agriculture. So this rich, rich land, they appropriated it. These existing completely cleared land, food production, and started commercial production of fibers, of cash crops, tobacco, cotton, sugar, rather than food crops. So they actually imported a lot of their food. And so it was a capitalist enterprise from the very beginning. So this was the introduction of African slavery. It already existed for a century. It was already existed in the Caribbean with the British colonies, but they were not settler colonies. They were overseer, just brutal, kind of like the French in Haiti and the British and the Barbados. And then some of those kinds of planters also opened the South Carolina colony, and they brought with them slave patrols. So the other, South Carolina had already been cleared. It was part of Virginia, had been cleared of or pushed back, the Tuscaroras, the native people there. So they brought in this brutal slave patrol system, and it got introduced in all the other colonies. And they were then formed out of these militias that had been formed to clear Indians. So these were not precursors to, let's say, the National Guard today in the Second Amendment. That was provided for in the, it's called state militias in the Constitution, but that's a genealogy of National Guard is in the Constitution, as well as the Army is in the Constitution originally. So the Bill of Rights was added later as individual rights. So this becomes the individual rights of any white settler to kill Indians and take their land. And then, that's exactly how across country the whole continent was taken.
And I want to sort of elucidate a little bit more on this cycle of slavers wanting to increase the size of their plantations, which meant more land had to be stolen and cleared or genocide committed against Native peoples. And that in turn, the growth of the plantations required more slaves to work them. And so there's this cycle of heinous acts feeding into each other. And both were dealt with by arming white folks and creating militias and slave patrols. Mm. How does that scenario, how does that cycle really set the groundwork for the gun culture that we continue to deal with?
Yeah, and when this was put into the Constitution, one of the 10 individual rights, it wasn't debated. It was already in the Virginia state constitution, the Massachusetts one, and several of them had formed state constitution when they declared independence. They declared independence as independent states, the Commonwealth of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and all. So the constitution created a federal system that entwined them together. And so it was simply transferred. Thomas Jefferson wrote the Bill of Rights. He wrote the Virginia Constitution. And he simply, transferred it. There was no debate. You can't find any kind of debate. Well, is this a good idea? Is this a bad idea? Or what does this mean? People can carry guns. Nothing like that. And that's true of the whole 100-year war they then, across the continent. And, of course, slavery for the next 70 years. It was simply a given. So in the 19th century, I think there was one court decision that actually, it wasn't the Supreme Court, but some court, there was a case and it only applied locally, that implied that this wasn't an individual right, but this was in the 1880s. But it didn't go through courts. It didn't become law or anything. And then there was nothing else until Congress in the 1930s during Prohibition, the Depression, and gangster warfare in Chicago, and bandits like Pretty Boy Floyd, the FBI were after, Congress decided to ban Thompson machine guns, war weapons. And they're called the Tommy guns, they were outgunning the police. And they actually brought the NRA in, the National Rifle Association, which then was kind of recreational, but they didn't make a fetish out of the Second Amendment, but they brought them in along with others to testify, would this violate the rights of the Second Amendment? And the NRA supported the ban. So this is the only legislation that ever took place. Then what happened is the post-World War II Black Freedom Movement burst out very quickly. So within 5 years, they were already going to the United Nations with We Charge Genocide, amazing document everyone should read. It's online. They were already supporting national liberation movements in decolonization in Africa. This is Paul Robeson, W.B. Du Bois, these people, they were revolutionaries, and they very quickly got the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954, desegregate the schools. That was like an earthquake, a tsunami for white nationalists. And, you know, up until that time, the entire country was nailed down as a white republic, Jim Crow in the South, legal segregation in the North, even with the diaspora from the South, complete control, police control. They didn't need the Ku Klux Klan anymore because the police department simply took over this role of controlling black people. Mm-hmm. And incarcerating them in great not like now, but great percentages, and suddenly this was threatened. So immediately you saw them organizing at the very high level. These very wealthy people formed the John Birch Society. 3 years after the decision, the Koch family was among the original founders, but
of the John Birch Society.
Yeah. Welch was Candy Scion, the inheritor of the Welch Candy fortune. They were all very wealthy. It wasn't a bunch of rednecks, forming the first white nationalist organization. It came from the top. And they became, of course, their mantra was impeach Earl Warren. It tells you where they're at, because that was the Chief Justice.
The Warren Court, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
The Warren Court. And I saw that growing up in Oklahoma. I was coming of age, an adolescent during that time in Oklahoma, and I had never heard of the John Birch Society, but I saw these signs everywhere, and I kept asking people, who is Earl Warren? I didn't know who Earl Warren was. Why? And no one, my parents couldn't really explain who he was either, but it attracted a lot of people, and a white nationalist guerrilla group formed called the Minutemen. And at that time, the FBI actually went after the Minutemen, kind of put them down. They didn't want insurrection, but they formed themselves very much like the old militias. Well, you had this lockdown. You had Indians on reservations. The Termination Act of 1953 was a process of doing away with all the land base of Native people, the relocation program. So you had people locked down almost in starvation, very poor conditions on reservations, or scattered. The young people scattered in all these different cities they were relocated to. So really, there was no threat until the rise of the Civil Rights Revolution. And that spread like wildfire, as we know, to women, to Puerto Ricans, socialism, to this interchange between South Africans under apartheid supporting civil rights in the United States and U.S. civil rights people supporting anti-apartheid activists, internationalized, Native people became internationalized. And so by 1975, you begin to see the visibility of many of these groups. And one of them, called the Second Amendment Association out of Washington State, which had formed in 1972, I think, they took over the NRA. So the NRA went from being a kind of hunting fetish, mostly, you know, with recreational or target shooting, to being a hardcore white nationalist group.
Which, and that was in the mid-70s.
Today.
Yeah. And that sea change, I think, is easy to miss for a lot of people, you know, thinking, well, the NRA, they're just protecting rights as a Second Amendment without noting the context, without noting the change in the pitch of their argument in relation to the civil rights movement and the revolutionary movements of the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, and, you know, that with that you have the proliferation of guns, because there weren't many... There weren't many gun laws. I know I was in, I tell my story in the beginning of this, of being in Louisiana, where we armed ourselves, and we went and did research at the library, what parameters, what we wanted to get legal guns. You know, we went to gun shows. We didn't know that, well, we didn't do that to escape any requirements, because the regular gun shops, which didn't sell used stuff, were just more expensive, but there were no laws. There were no state laws. And all guns were controlled by the states. The federal government had little authority. So the only federal law in the books was crossing state lines for the purpose of committing a felony. You know, and there was this arsenal. The state of Louisiana said couldn't build an arsenal for the purpose of insurrection or... which came to apply to us, insurrection or to commit a crime. But an arsenal was 50 guns.
Oh.
You know, I mean, anything below that. And
48 guns? Well, you know, you're a hobbyist.
And no limitation on ammunition or gunpowder. So we just, okay, so we started accumulating guns. But that was the way it was in most states. And famously, you know, in 1968, the Black Panthers, who were doing this, it was almost like a the Zapatistas, a more like a what do you call it, a symbol. The gun was more of a symbol than a instrument at first, and where they stopped and, you know, they had their law books, they're reading to the police, and it was really an amazing organization in Oakland.
And that's when the Black Panthers took the state capitol in California.
Well, yeah, they were, the legislature was meeting to, not because of the Panthers, but they had had this already in you know, in the works to put some restrictions on carrying guns in public, loaded guns. It was perfectly, California had no guns laws either. And there was tremendous opposition to it, tremendous opposition, even though the NRA wasn't involved, just the, you know, my Okie, descendants of my Okie Dust Bowl people out in the valley, they're all, you know, gun nuts and opposed it. And, you know, the even the police at that time, I think, opposed it. But what made the Panthers famous was they went to the Capitol grounds with loaded shotguns, which was totally legal at the time, to lobby against the law, which made it quickly pass. It wouldn't have passed otherwise. So I say everyone should look at that to see a little guerrilla theater. Of course, now you probably just get shot down. But But this made them famous.
Absolutely.
But the law wasn't designed. I mean, no one even knew about the Panthers yet. You know, it wasn't really that process. You know how legislators are very slow, and that had been going through before the Panthers were even founded. But it wasn't likely to win until they appeared. So
and which just scared the bejeebies out of the white power holders.
And, of course, that just upped the membership of these white nationalist groups organizing, and many of them up here in the Northwest. You know, this is a hotbed.
Absolutely.
Eastern, well, you know, from the Mormon militias, I call them, in Eastern Oregon and in Eastern Washington. These are a real hotbed of white nationalism.
Absolutely.
All these groups that started in the 80s.
And, you know, I'm going to sort of look at a little more historical context there. Former slavers spread rumors after slavery was ended, spread rumors that the freedmen were organizing insurrection to seek revenge and kill white people. And the tactic of spreading that kind of false narrative about, spreading the fear of black and brown people is a narrative that we see continuing, whether it's the story of the cop who kills an unarmed man, unarmed black or brown person, who says, well, they had no choice. They were afraid for their lives. Mm-hmm. Their very presence, their existence was threatening to the armed and trained police officer. We also see that as recently as last week on Twitter, where there were several claims that white people were attacked by black people when they tried to see the Black Panther, which opened last weekend and has a primarily black cast. And suddenly there was a spate of posts to Twitter with pictures of white faces that were bloodied, that had black eyes. Savvy users of the internet were able to find these stock photos from either makeup portfolios, you know, makeup artist portfolios, or
photoshopping.
Just taken from another incident, had nothing to do with anything, you know, pictures several years old. We saw that also when the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, started coming into prominence. And again, the narratives of white folks damaging their own property and blaming it on black people. So that narrative plays into this fear, and the fear plays into the need, heavy quotation marks, to be heavily armed as white people to protect our homeland, our families, our communities. Can you speak to that narrative?
Yeah, it's. I would emphasize that even though there's certainly a gun culture throughout the 19th century and up to this uptick. And by the way, the mass shootings rose in parallel. You can find a few mass shootings in the past, but mostly, they're very, very dubious. The first one really was the Texas Tower, in 1964. And this was, you know, I think we also have to consider the whole context there, because this was the Vietnam War was heating up, the assassination of John Kennedy, how much he was hated. I don't think people realize how people were celebrating. I know in Oklahoma, children in Tulsa, it was reported that children in Tulsa applauded when the teacher came in and told them that John Kennedy had been killed. Because a part of this whole Ku Klux Klan and Christian identity thing is the hatred for Catholics. So that was still very, you know, they've all become right wing now, so it's not, no more hatred for Catholics, but I don't think they're still allowed in the Masons or in some of these organizations. But I remember that clearly, being only a couple of years from being in Oklahoma. And the day I saw that morning paper, the day Kennedy was killed, I opened the San Francisco Chronicle and saw Kennedy is going to be in Dallas. I said, oh, my God, he shouldn't go there. And I was not surprised when it happened. You know, I said, why did he go to Dallas with a bare head? You know, I say, in a motorcade. And it was, but I think most people just weren't aware of this subterranean. Even today, they marginalize. They say, oh, these people are all just a bunch of marginal, crazy people. But when you have the whole thing coming from a right-wing top, you know, if you really look at where it's come from, who's funding this stuff? And the fact that the entire Republican Congress now is pretty much in line with white nationalism and has been for quite a while. And I think during the Reagan years, I can't believe how he's being restored as the good guy and the opposite of Trump. And I mean, he set the whole thing up, the green lights, the language, the fact that he went to Bitburg, you know, the Nazi, where the right. Nazi soldiers are buried, right off. He went for his inauguration to the site where the civil rights workers were killed by the Ku Klux Klan and buried in a dam. And this, you know, Trump Jr. did that during Trump's thing. So these were all signals. These are signals to these right wing. And I've always been, you know, attuned to these signals because growing up in rural Oklahoma, they were the norm rather than the exception.
Right.
And other people, like urban people, just, they don't see it. It's like, and it's really kind of scary, you know. They'll notice anything leftists do, Black Lives Matter, whatever. They're threatening us. But, you know, this real truth threat of fascism. That's why I'm very supportive of the Antifa people. I think they're really the only ones raising. They're not always on the mark of what brought it about. They kind of trace it to European fascism more than I, you know, looking at the grassroots.
The
here.
Homegrown fascism.
Yeah, but, you know, I still am glad somebody's out there, you know, to other young people trying to say, this is not okay. You know, this is not okay for these people to take the streets and take our campuses.
The whole debate over if it's all right to allow Nazis and other open white supremacist and fascists to be present on campuses, to organize on campuses, that we are even having that debate kind of blows my mind.
Well, and so many, like all these free speech veterans from UC Berkeley that, you know, they have an organization, they constantly celebrate themselves. But it's not the first time, but it is worse this time. They're self-righteous. This is not, you know, when it happens at Berkeley, this is not in our tradition, as if they own some tradition of free speech.
Right.
And it's, you know, I thought it was not that politically important even at the time, you know, didn't go far enough. But for it to be written in stone, you know, this ACLU, First Amendment rights fundamentalism, is I think, stupid, you know, that other countries, you know, Germany, England, all they have... France, punishment for hate crimes, you know, fascist hate crimes. It's not a balance either, you know, that the left is the same as the extreme right, which is the narrative here. Mm-hmm. That's ridiculous. How many people have been killed by leftists? How many people have been threatened, except other fascists?
Right.
I don't think they've even killed any fascists.
No, but there's been a couple of punches thrown, and suddenly there's a demonization of the left of, look, they're just as bad. Right. They are just as violent. In Charlottesville, you know, we heard that come out strongly, even after the white supremacists had killed one of the protesters and beaten, severely beaten others. A punch gets thrown in, or there's some self-defense going on, and you see that violence is on both sides. It is so ahistoric, and it is such propaganda.
I think a lot of it is understandable as denial. Mm. The, you know, one of the other things I discuss, and a whole book before this was about indigenous people's history of the United States, is in the denial. I mean, people might have the rhetoric, oh, yeah, bad things happened, there was genocide, and it's almost then like, well, there are no more Indians, and that's really sad. And then there was slavery, but there was this civil war, this revolution. Aren't we great? And Lincoln was great, and we overthrew it. But look where we are today, you know, and the militarism that gets left out, the influence of militarism. This kid in in this rich white suburb of Miami. Have you noticed that all these kids are white? I don't know. I've never heard it mentioned. It's very rich and white, and that's fine because they're getting a lot more attention than, you know, kids at poor schools get when they're subjected to gun violence. Or these poor schools, you know, like the one in San Diego County that hardly anyone paid any attention mm-hmm. to. But I'm glad they're getting noticed and they're taking advantage of their privilege by taking a stand. But this kid, and it's very big there with these 3,000 students, junior ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
And junior ROTC was founded in the Defense Act of 1916.
Hmm.
National Defense Act, 1916. And it was mainly to train kids to fight, you know, fight the labor movement then. I mean, to teach them to kill, but also to go into World War One, all the, you know, the occupations and wars mm-hmm. in Nicaragua and Haiti, the occupation of Haiti during that time, the occupation of Nicaragua by the Marines. And so this kid had been training since he was 11 years old.
Right.
And he was wearing the shirt. He was dressed in the uniform when he killed. So he was obviously doing it as a JROTC soldier. And yet, no one, you know, the press has made nothing of that.
Yeah.
And this is in schools throughout the country, 3,000 schools. And our taxes pay for it. It comes from the Defense Department. Schools pay for it, but they're public schools, so people's taxes. And all I've heard from the Democratic Party people and liberals, gun control people, is the NRA gives grants of about $10,000 to that school, but they do in-kind equipment, you know, the guns and the targets and stuff like that. Peanuts compared to how much it costs.
Right.
So the NRA is held up as a bogeyman, and we do this left and right in the United States, the bogeyman, and then not looking underneath at the overall cause of violence in the United States, the past, but also continuing wars against brown people.
Absolutely. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is Positively Revolting this morning, and I'm Ani, your host. This morning, we are delighted to be able to have an hour with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Her recent book just came out last month. It's called Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. You can call in and be a part of this conversation. The studio line is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. We're also live streaming this on Facebook. You can like Positively Revolting's page on Facebook. You'll find us there. We're live streaming on the KBOO page on Facebook. Also, I want to remind you, you can follow along during the week on Twitter. You can find us at Positive Revolt. And I also want to remind you, so much reminding going on this morning, that KBOO is in the midst of our Kickstarter campaign to ensure that we are able to continue our accessible and free training, to continue building a city of media makers, be a part of that effort, contribute to our Kickstarter campaign. You can find it at kboo.fm/Kickstarter. You can also share that with your social media feeds and spread the word of the good work of People's Media. It's participatory media, and you're a part of it. Thanks for listening, and you can call in again at 503-231-8187. There's so much to talk about in the remaining 20 minutes, 26 minutes. I want to talk about the Wild West narrative, right? That we have this myth of the Wild West. It's become synonymous with the idealized image of America, home of the free, land of the brave, the six shooters becoming a symbol of that freedom. Just about every kid I know has at some point in their childhood played cowboys and Indians, and that, you know, very sanitized, making genocide a playground game is something that we could probably devote a couple weeks to. But here we are having 25 minutes. If we can also look at some of the American folk heroes of the Wild West, like Davy Crockett, and as I'm finding out from reading your book, Jesse James, not such the Robin Hood I had always sort of idealized him to be. Can we talk about how the myths of the Wild West and our mythic heroes play into our gun culture?
Well, you know, I have this chapter on Confederate guerrillas and how that is a very important, that's a kind of the predecessor of kind of the militias that were provided for in the Second Amendment during the Civil War. And they were all over the South. The Union had their Union guerrillas too. But the ones in Missouri where slavery wasn't outlawed, but it wasn't legalized, and it wasn't that common, but certainly there were many, many small scale slave owners, including Jesse James' family and all the Confederate guerrillas. But their war for 10 years before the Civil War was with the abolitionists in Kansas. That was an all-out war, guerrilla war. And this is where these Confederate guerrillas in the Civil War came from, was killing abolitionists. They actually created a new way of mass murder. And I hate to even say it because it might give some mass killer ideas, but they see it in the movies, but it kind of seems like play, just what cowboys did. But it wasn't cowboys. It was invented by these Confederate guerrillas.
Right.
The new six shooter that was, you know, many, many new weapons were created in the Indian Wars. And by the Civil War, there were some really, you know, the Colt. But this six shooter, so riding a horse, they were very good horsemen, riding a horse very fast, with six shooter in each hand, riding without reins because they had their horses very well trained, and ride by shooting into people's houses, abolitionist houses, and killing them.
Right.
But they also went and killed hundreds of people in Lawrence, Kansas, in a slaughter, and those people being from Ohio and Massachusetts, you know, who moved there. John Brown was there for a time too. To fight the slave owners and keep slavery out of Kansas, they were all asleep. It was in the middle of the night, and they had all their weapons in an armory, not with them. Which, you know, when you're in a war, you might should have your weapons with you. If you came to do a war.
If you came in for the war, that does make some sense.
But it's so tragic because they were just slaughtered in their beds.
Yeah.
And burned the whole town down. So that was Jesse James, the Quantrill's Raiders. And actually it was Jesse James' brother who was older, who was the first one. He brought Jesse in when he was 15, and eventually, as many were killed off, Jesse became leader at a very young age. So one person, I've been studying these Confederate guerrillas for years because they were my childhood heroes, and I didn't know they were Confederate guerrillas. I was really fanatically anti-racist and anti-Confederacy. I hated the sight of a Confederate flag, and I find out my heroes, my Robin Hoods, were all murderous, psychopathic mass killers.
Right.
You know, and families of slave owners. So I've been writing this biography of Belle Starr for many years, and that she was the one woman. And she wasn't just someone's sidekick. She was actually from a very pro-slave family. They had slaves. They were well-to-do. They ran a hotel, a lodge, and they were merchants, you know, in Missouri. And she was very young, like 14, when the Civil War started. So she was a courier, you know, riding horseback, a courier, and armed, too. Well, they all became, you know, after they were defeated, they became bandits. robbing trains, robbing banks. They weren't really very good at it. But they caught the, you know, there was this just this forgetfulness of, they were able to wipe out their past and create a new image of themselves. So in most people's minds, Jesse James and Billy the Kid were like friends or something, you know. Jesse James was never in New Mexico. He was in Indian Territory. They hid out there, you know, in Indian Territory, mm-hmm. Oklahoma, eastern Oklahoma. But they were, you know, they were in Missouri. Some went to Texas. Outlaw Josie Wales, a real person mm-hmm. that the movie was made on, as a hero.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of these Confederate guerrillas. And so they're you know, in pop culture. And then there's the song of the band, you know, that became probably one of the best-selling singles ever was the night they drove old Dixie down.
Yeah.
So I've had more lefties from my generation object to that than anything else in this book.
Right.
I mean, giving excuses for them. And I said, yeah, but what I mean is not that they're evil, but it's like, you know, it's like in our blood vessels. I mean, black people didn't like that song.
Right.
It was a very white nationalist,
very
Confederate
it's
song.
Always confused me as somebody who, yeah. you know, heard that song and knew of it being a classic.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm 51 now. You know, so it had been 15 years. You know, from it being a big hit, from when I first heard it, and I'm thinking, why? You know, this doesn't make any sense.
And Robbie Robertson.
One of these songs is not like the others. Yeah,
yeah.
Curious.
So and Joan Baez covered it.
Yeah.
All these people covered it.
Yeah.
It was raved. It was never criticized. And I think there's such a segregation of white and black culture that probably black people just ignored it. They didn't listen to, you know, didn't listen to white singers.
Well, you know, and the band, really. I mean,
and
you
the
know,
band.
They, yeah. So.
But at the time, I mean, I was woke enough, as I said,
yeah.
And already a historian and already studied these things, that I was appalled
yeah.
at the time. I said, I liked Robbie Robertson. He's a Mohawk Indian.
Right.
You know, he's from Canada. So I think it was LaVon Helms, who's, you know, a Confederate supporter, a good old boy. I mean, that it was tragic, the lost cause. You know, they had a lot of sympathy.
There's a lot of the idea of, well, we might not like what the Confederates stood for, but the idea of rebels.
Yeah, rebels and
you know,
independence.
And they fought for what they believed in, right or wrong.
And not taking orders from the big government, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
that, and again, that's another myth. That,
yeah. So it's, and even, you know, Robert E. Lee is just now coming for the first time. For white people, it is really, I would say, white people, probably 20% of white people now, really think it's repugnant to have, you know, Robert E. Lee in the Hall of Statuary in D.C., not just in, you know, southern inch of the South.
Well, we have people calling in to join in our conversation. We also have somebody who is asking the pertinent question, why are you in town anyway? You'll be speaking at Powell's tonight.
Thank you.
And we want to make sure that folks know that they can hear more from you tonight at Powell's. That's the downtown city of books. And that's at 7:30, yes?
I think it's at 7. And it's also supposed to be raining, but you're used to the rain here.
We're used to the rain.
Portlanders,
we can
come out anyway.
We can deal with the rain. yeah, and such an important opportunity to hear you read from Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment. We're, again, thankful for the opportunity to speak with you here live in studio this morning. And let's go ahead and talk to James. Good morning, James.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing okay. How are you?
I'm good. You know, I happened upon this channel by accident, and I'm glad I did, because, you know, a lot of the things that I'm hearing right now, you know, our history, you know, folks get very comfortable with what they think, you know, our history is as Americans, and I'm hearing, you know, so many things. Some of the things that I'm hearing are very surprising. Well, some things are not surprising to me, and some things were very surprising to me. And I just had a couple of questions. You know, with the complacency and people being comfortable, how do you really take the information that you're talking about and really kind of try to wake people up? Because, you know, it's in my, you know, I'm a bleeding heart liberal myself. And what I found is something that you talked about, which was that, you know, sometimes, you know, liberals protect some of these, you know, falsehoods for the sake of that this is just how they grew up. So, you know, when I hear you talking about, you know, some of these things, it's like, you know, these, and you're talking about the hard truths of America, you know? How do you convey these things to folks? Well, they'll want to accept it.
How do you actually get actual history across to people to combat the myths that were taught in schools?
I think, you know, I used to get very frustrated with it, you know, the especially the left, you know, not just liberals, but I know liberal politicians, you know, they're trying to not offend the people. They want to get elected. I'm telling you, I wouldn't get elected to anything, that's for sure. But those of us who aren't trying to get elected or to be class president or something, I don't see why we can't be honest with ourselves, among each other at least. And I think there's a lot of denial among people who think they're very, very radical, mm-hmm. that they buy into it more. Also, that there's a lot of white nationalism, an assumption of superiority that is a kind of built in. And it's not a flaw or evil. It's the culture, but to become aware of it is the only way to then work it out. Not just how to be nice or not say slur words or, you know, insulting words about minorities or women or whatever, but rather to, you know, go deeper. And unfortunately, the only people I really see that go deeper, and I mean the only people, are among Native people, especially young Native scholars today, but activists in the past, AIM people. They know this stuff. They know the oral history. They know their relatives who were killed, their grandfathers and great-grandfathers, and way back. The victims never forget. African descendants of slavery also know that. They have their oral history. They know, and they're fantastic African-American historians. That is all known. But there are these two parallel things that were absolutely interdependent: taking of the land by violence and violating, taking of human property by violence and maintaining both by violence, that are completely intertwined, including the resistance. And that's what I have hope in, and it's kind of beginning, is that crossover. I think that would be extremely powerful, more than just the Native narrative and the African American Native separately, because things get left out. During the Civil War, is never written in that there was a major war the Union was carrying on, Union Army, Lincoln's Army in Minnesota against the Dakota people, the Dakota farmers, settled people. They had brought all these Scandinavian starving refugees in and said, here, you can take this land. But it was already taken. You know, it was Dakota land. So the Dakotas fought back. They burned down these structures and houses and killed Scandinavian settlers. So there was this war, side war going on. There was this war going on against the Apaches and the Comanches in the Southwest. The Navajo Nation was rounded up and deported. Kit Carson was given a Union Army temporary colonel, you know, in charge of it, and he was a well-known Indian killer, rounded up, and half of them died in a concentration camp in southeastern New Mexico in the hot desert. So these were all, and the Sand Creek Massacre of the Northern Cheyenne in Colorado. It was carried out by Colorado irregulars, that means militias, that had, you know, had no Confederates to fight. So they just went and killed all these people living under a white flag, on a government reservation with no arms whatsoever. They massacred them. So all of this happened during the Civil War, plus the Homestead Act was passed during the Civil War. And this was a new way of taking Indian land, you know, for settlers. So we have to have this you know, this... and then, of course, the other overlap is some of the Native people in the South had taken up the culture of the Americans of slave owning, and a small percentage of them owned slaves. So they actually, the Cherokees, Choctaws, Chickasaws, and Seminoles, fought on the side of the Confederacy. They hated the federal government for their own reasons, but they, you know, the elite also wanted to preserve slavery. So you have these contradictions, and then you have the soldiers, the combat soldiers, the incredible black combat soldiers who were reformed as buffalo soldiers to go kill Lakota people in the Northern Plains. So you have this complicated history, and this is how colonialism works. And a lot of times I think leftists can't handle complications. You think you have to, well, have this side and that side and be balanced, but not just, hey, dig into, you know, what really happened, what this country is really about. It's really interesting, you know, and to what Samir Amin says, that the trouble, he was talking about Europeans, but also Euro-Americans, is being able to detach yourself from white supremacy, to detach yourself and admit to, you know, really these crimes of the last 500 years of we're still pursuing.
And but, you know, when you talk about these things, you really bring tears to my eyes. Listen, I am a black guy who was, you know, I have lived in every possible situation. I'm a child of poverty, but my mother, you know, worked hard and got help, and we found ourselves in the suburbs. And, you know, I found myself, you know, seeing folks in the suburbs with the mindset, and I was learning about our history. And one thing I heard you brought up Oklahoma earlier. One thing I was hoping that you would talk about is something that mortifies me, is the massacre that happened in Oklahoma. You know, they call it, you know, the Black Wall Street,
right,
you know, massacre. And, you know, as we start talking about, you know, this new movie that came out, you know, Black Panther, which celebrates, you know, African and black excellence, you know, I can only really think about, you know, what black excellence was back then, and then how it was just taken. And a lot of people don't realize that had happened. So when I hear you talking about all these things, it's just, I will be at your reading tonight.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, James. We need to let you go, as we are quickly running out of show.
Absolutely.
But
thank you, James.
Good. Hope to see you tonight at Powell's. And again, I'm going to mention that's Powell's downtown, City of Books. And that's 7. Get there early. You know, I'm thinking this is going to be a popular
event. Can I read one thing?
Please.
As we end?
Yeah.
This is a brief poem by Sherman Alexie, a wonderful Spokane Native poet, filmmaker. It's from his last year's book, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, which is a wonderful book.
Yeah.
It's not all poetry, but he has this poem, and I think it's incredible. So I have it in the book. So, if ever built, what will the United States Native American Genocide Memorial Museum contain? What will it exhibit? It will be one room, a 54 square, with the same large photo filling the walls, ceiling, and floor. There will only be one visitor allowed in at any one time. There will be no furniture. That one visitor will have to stand or sit on the floor or lie on the floor if they feel the need. That visitor must remain in that room for 1 hour. There will be no music. The only soundtrack will be random gunshots from rifles used throughout American history. Reverberation. What will that one photo be? It will be an Indian baby shredded by a Gatling gun, lying dead and bloody in the snow.
That is so powerful. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, thank you so very much for joining us this morning on Positively Revolting. Thank you for joining us on KABU. Hope to see you tonight.
Good.
And with that, we'll be back next week. I'll be speaking with Andrea Williams from CAUSA about immigrant rights. Do join us and remember to support KABU's Kickstarter campaign. You are a part of Independent People's Media. Support our free training program and help us get audio activist tools into the hands of the people. That's go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter.
This is KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. Coming up next at 9 o'clock, it's One Land, Many Voices discussing pinkwashing in Seattle, Portland, and Toronto. At 10 on Valley Views, Dale looks into OSU's plans for demolishing the Sunflower House. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And 11, Pacific Underground talks to filmmaker and Slants band member Joek Zhang about his Jade District stories, exploring the businesses and people with deep roots in the area. KBOO's Kickstarter is live. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter and help KBOO build a city of media makers. That's kboo.fm/Kickstarter. And coming up now, it's One Land, Many Voices.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy